Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Wherever you are, this is the Interpreter's Workshop Podcast. I'm Tim Curry, your host. Here we talk everything sign language interpreting. The ins, the outs, the ups, the downs, the sideways of interpreting. If you're a student, a new interpreter, experienced interpreter, this is the place for you. If you want to know more, go to interpretersworkshop.com. Let's start talking interpreting. And now, the quote of the day. Today, I have two quotes. The first one by Roy Thompson, Canadian publisher and once the richest man in the world. You carry your country with you. It's part of your baggage. The second by José Antonio Vargas, a journalist and filmmaker, born in the Philippines and raised in the U.S. I'm not a minority. I'm a majority of one. We all are. To call someone a minority, you give them baggage of not being full or not being seen as full. All of us need to be seen as full human beings. In today's episode, we continue the conversation with Marco Nardi, Italian sign language interpreter living in the UK. We learn a little bit more of how these quotes help interpreters or hinder interpreters. Your worldview is influenced by the country where you're from, the country that you're carrying with you, the politics, the emotional baggage, the communication culture, the culture itself. All of those influence who you are and how you relate to the world. In this episode, Marco discusses how these influences mentioned in these quotes affect us as interpreters and as human beings. Let's start talking with Marco. So, just to be clear, what languages do an Italian sign language interpreter use in Italy, I should say?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Italian sign language interpreters, most of them work between Italian sign language and Italian. Mm-hmm. But as I mentioned, Italy do have dialects. Mm-hmm. So not only vernacular, for example, Florentine is a vernacular, is not fully fledged dialect. So it's very, in other words, just to give an explanation, is much closer to the Italian standardized, whatever mm-hmm. people want to use, language compared to a dialect. A dialect have a strong influences from other languages or other origins. So, mm-hmm. for example, if we are talking about Sardinian, and there are two versions of Sardinian, there is the North Sardinian and the Southern Sardinian. One is influenced from Latin and the other one is influenced from Spanish. And there are times where Sardinian use the dialects where I absolutely do not understand a word. Mm-hmm. There are other situations where you might guess what that word, because they are Latin based, so sometimes we have similar mm-hmm. origins in our vocabulary, but otherwise sometimes you just absolutely no idea what they're saying. So yeah. Again, I'm not saying that is used for work purposes, but there are situations, I'm sure, that if you are in that city, mm-hmm. that the individual working with in a certain situation might revert to that dialect rather than using or imposing Italian, depending on the situation. And then there are interpreters that live in border regions with France and with former Yugoslavian countries, and therefore they might be multilingual. Mm-hmm. Just to add, there are a number of interpreters that, because of their individual education, might know other languages, because Italy being a country where the language is not used in many other parts of the world, we tend to study other languages a bit more than other countries. So we tend to have people that know French, German, Italian, Spanish a bit more than, mm-hmm. than in other places. So we tend to have a bit more than just two languages in our baggage of languages.
Baggage is a good word for that. Yes.
It could be a good thing, and it could be a derogative thing. It could be a baggage and a negative.
So how did you wind up in the UK? That was a big jump in topic, I know, but...
There are two reasons. First of all, because I met what is my husband now. So again, socializing with the deaf community in Florence, they organized to visit Brother and Sister, which is a LGBTQ plus deaf club organization in London. And they were celebrating the 15th anniversary at the time, 30 years ago. And the group of deaf young people in Florence wanted to join that celebration, and they asked me to support them with faxing at the time, again, talking about technology of the time. So faxing in English.
That's F-A-X for those younger
generation. F-A-X, the younger generation.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not a mispronunciation of another word. To use the fax machine, F-A-X machine, facsimile, just in case.
Yes.
That's the original fully written word, was facsimile. And also occasionally to call, make telephone call again to hotel in London, and therefore they needed someone that spoke English. So I supported them to do all that process, booking flights, etc. And then after through the process, they noticed my, not upset, but they could read me a bit. I was rather disappointed about something. And one of them suddenly had the brilliant idea to ask me, would you like to join us? So I said, yes. So I joined them, just to cut it short. And then during New Year's Eve, I met what became eventually my husband in the United Kingdom. So he's an indigenous person. I know Anglophone don't like those words, aboriginal, indigenous. He's a person that was born in the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the reasons. I could never deny that. But as in conversation with John, my husband, he said, I don't want the responsibility, you know, to have the big burden of having you to move to another country, give up everything, your family, your work, etc., your friends there, to come here on my shoulder. So make sure that you find somebody else. I'm sure that you might sympathize. So there was another opportunity, which was to study at Durham University to do this MA, Master of Art in British Sign Language, English Interpreting. The reason why I wanted to attend that, because by then I was already working as a sign language interpreter, and somehow I had already done a number of prominent jobs, like working with a deaf MP in the Italian Parliament, a member of Parliament. So it was quite a situation, as you can imagine, serious type of situation you found yourself in. However, I still hadn't cracked what it meant to be an interpreter from an academic perspective. So I knew the ins and outs at that point, because I was doing it. I was literally doing it. And I was requested all the things that are part of being wanted, being booked. It's what we want as professionals.
Yeah.
But it wasn't enough for me at that point anymore. I wanted to be able to verbalize, to express what I was doing and being eloquent with it. And therefore, I was fortunate enough that I applied to Durham and I was accepted. So that's why I moved to the United Kingdom. And then United Kingdom was welcoming at the time, so I'm not necessarily sure about it now. Not that United Kingdom doesn't want me, but it's slightly less welcoming country-wise at the moment. You have to be careful. You might end up in Rwanda.
So that makes you a Brexpat? Okay.
It sounded like a very strange custard, because crème pâtissière, which is a version of custard in British English, at least.
So how do you find interpreting in the UK, or how did you find interpreting in the UK compared to interpreting in Italy?
As I said, it was a very welcoming country, and the deaf community especially, I have to say, was very welcoming and accepting. I had a gear extra to some British colleagues, and it's really strange to say that, but being Italian, I was slightly more expressive. So it was much easier for me to use non-manual features like facial expressions, body posture and movement, etc., to enhance the mere language, the mere sign itself. In the United Kingdom especially, I'm not sure United States, but especially in the United Kingdom, this Victorian overwhelming not to pull faces, not to gesticulate, etc., is entrenched in the DNA of people living here. So to reach that level in which deaf people appreciate your refined ability to express yourself takes quite a while. Okay. So when I came and I arrived with all my Italianism, if you allow me to say, the deaf community was very accepting or welcoming of that. They were really appreciative. And however, I always had a complex of inferiority complex towards the spoken side, you know, spoken English,
because of course,
no matter what, I've been living here for 30 years and I know now that I can live with it, but I do have the misnomer is an accent, but it's not really, English doesn't have an accent because there is no accent in English, but anyway, it's a misnomer, it's an inflection. I place stress in the wrong place. And sometimes the initial H and or non-H in words. Even yesterday, my father-in-law said that you cannot cook hair because he used the air fryer, but I cannot pronounce air fryer because it's very difficult not to do the H at the beginning of it. So I tend to say hair fryer. It's like you keep saying that I'm frying my follicles.
Yeah.
So it will never change for me. There is something that it is possible or not, no matter. I'm sure I could go to a speech therapist or a locutionist, I don't think it's worth it. maybe one day. But it makes people sometimes smile and laugh. And there are words that I cannot pronounce, like S-H. E-E-T always end up being the rude words with S-H-I-T.
Yes.
And I, in class, obviously, when the tutor said, oh, pick one of these. So I always end up changing the version. And although the lip pattern of the deaf person is that word, I always said, piece of paper.
Yes.
Take the first folio or whatever. I just use other synonyms and avoid those words. And if you're talking about the bed, then it becomes covers or linen or other terms to avoid, again, the same words.
Yes. Well, for me as English, I would say I had my aunt, her name was F-A-N-N-Y.
Yep.
And which means something different in
Absolutely.
Regions of English.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just have to kind of live with that.
Live with it. Yeah.
We all have to live with it somehow. Share this podcast with those who are just living with it. And while you're at it, send me an extra coffee. Just click on the links in the show notes. Thank you so much. Let's go back to Marco.
I was thinking about another word that it's like we talk about... We talk about, this is really random. We talk about being night owls or morning lark. Yeah, that's the expression. Yeah. I always wondered why morning lark? Could they use the other animal that's, you know, scream at in the morning to wake you up?
Yes.
The cockerel. Because again, in English, in the British English, nobody say the real word
yes.
of the animal because it's always... perceived as rude and people giggle. So it's been transformed now in the diminutive, which is cockerel rather than the other word. Because again, everybody thinks it's the rude.
Yes, exactly. And did you learn these after you arrived?
Yeah, these are cultural. They're cultural. Again, this is another perhaps important curiosity. When you learn languages in other countries, we tend to have non-mother tongue or first language user teaching you. So I had, in most cases, Italian people teaching me English. So they were highly qualified. Mm-hmm. They spend lots of time in England or in the United States or whichever other country where English is spoken. However, they brought their own idiosyncrasies and defects in that teaching, and therefore we acquired that. Not only that, but they were following a curriculum that expects you to learn that the way they introduce yourself in English is by using "How do you do?" So I arrived in the United Kingdom, and the first person I met, I said, "How do you do?" And the person responded, "Ooh, you think you are?" because only aristocracy now use that term, or very formal type of situation. It's not the everyday expression. So again, you learn something as a norm, and then you come to the country and you have to relearn the cultural way in which people express themselves. Yeah, so yeah. All these things have been learned in situ in the United Kingdom.
And I think that probably goes back to the first thing that you mentioned about learning sign language and how that has evolved into more academic focus rather than community socializing focus, learning the language. And when you learn the language, you learn kind of a standardized, because you have to follow a curriculum, you follow a certain vocabulary lists, etc. And that's how you learn the language rather than that flow within a cultural context.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if one of the two sides is missing, obviously the individual is skewed on one direction rather than having the balanced approach and being able to draw from both sides of the language.
That comes with experience. That speaks to the fact that we as interpreters have to have ongoing education, because as we gain experience interpreting, we start to learn new barriers that we have within ourselves in the language or the skill sets, and that ongoing education can help us move past those.
I have a point that I've been talking to individuals for a number of years now. I never done anything with it, so I'm not sure. So this might not be new, might have been discussed already, but perhaps I wasn't in those situations, so I'm not claiming it as completely mine. But the point is that in many cases, not everywhere in the world, please don't take it as a blanket statement, but we have been educated as interpreter with what I call assault training because of the high demand of interpreters. So in many countries, suddenly the community required interpreters because deaf people needed to access various settings. And therefore, the lack of them forced the educational institution, internal deaf community themselves, or external institution to set themselves up like the word training come from the wartime. So the army had the need to create soldiers very quickly, and therefore they were training them in order to go to war, to battle. And we've done the same things with interpreter, the fastest possible, the quickest way, you know, the way that you could just send them out and work. I think now we need to pull the brake and go back, and we need to stop assault training of interpreters, and we need to educate them. And by that, perhaps it's a slightly antiquated approach, But I think we will benefit our profession to be all first translators and then interpreters, meaning working with semi-fixed languages at the beginning, written language or recorded spoken languages, and work translating them into signed languages, recorded. Now we can, we have many way to do that. It's slightly cheaper to do it.
Yeah.
So it's not prohibitive like it was in the past, and vice versa. Lots of recording of deaf people presenting, social interaction and working and translating, so that we can build up these toolkits. These, I think you were talking to Jonathan Downey in one of the interviews. He was talking about these preconceived sentences that you can go back to very quickly.
Yes.
There might be some negative things attached to that, but at least to have them, you know, up your sleeves that you can go back to if you need them, to use the energy, like you, I think, responded to that interview. And save energy and to give energy to other area of your interpretation.
Yeah,
I think this, again, it's not the same way that spoken language interpreters are educated anymore, because there are, they switch now into assault training as well. Somehow fallen into that trap. So some of those institutes that did do translator and then specialization into interpreter, they're now gone. Translator is one thing, is interpreter another.
Yeah.
But I think our profession for at least a period would benefit from that approach. So for all of us to become interpreter, doesn't matter if you're hearing or deaf, just becoming translators first and then move on into the interpreting profession. Because I think, as I said, that element of the community where we were practicing on individuals live, but is a no-no.
Yes.
Don't recommend that. It's not fair on the deaf community. But yeah, it's missing now. So I think going back and reflecting on this would be, but not many places do that. They do say they do translation first, but it's an introduction to what translation is. They make you do some exercises, but then they very quickly move on into the interpreting part of the training or education, the course, because that's what is required of those individuals at the end of the, for most of them. At the end of their qualification, and that—that's my that my top answer of my of my sense, I think, is the American expression, two cents.
Exactly. With translation, we would learn a lot of the interpreting process skills, but in a slow way and in a very safe way.
Apply them to interpreting. Absolutely, absolutely.
Like you mentioned, some programs start with a little bit of the translation, but it may only be a few months, and then you're quickly moved on to the rest of the assault course because of the need and the time constraints.
Absolutely. And the financial, financial implicature. I'm not ignoring.
No.
I'm very well aware of all those factors.
Yeah.
But still, I still think it's a valid point that perhaps we ignore the translation side of things and too quickly move on into interpreting.
Yeah. Knowing the languages that you do, how has that affected your interpreting work? And have you seen a development of those influences, or an involvement, I should say, of your work because of those influences?
I think it's very important. This is another addition. So absolutely, I respond to your question. But just to add, the importance that I was talking about earlier on about Italy having a number of languages to your toolkit, to your baggage, whichever you want to call it. it's very important because in different culture, in different languages, people use different expressions, different concepts, and sometimes one could be illuminating for you to work with your sign language, because sometimes the variation between your the spoken language you use in your country and the sign language is wider than between the sign language and another spoken language. So I know it's a bit complex as a concept, but sometimes the way they express a concept in French, for example, is an absurdity, but yeah, in French is much closer to the way deaf people express themselves in British Sign Language than it is to spoken English. Yeah. So having the knowledge of other spoken or sign languages can help you just, oh, but I know that in that culture, this concept is expressed with this completely different approach. And you can resort to using that, or at least trying using that. And that's why I'm saying that knowing a number of languages have helped me sometime coming away from the spoken language or the automatic, oh, I don't know how to do it, I'll do it in signed English or in signed Italian, or yeah, that's sometimes the default, I don't know how to express it in sign language of that country, I'll just go back to the signed version of it and giving up. So sometimes knowing other languages helps to avoid that by default going into signed something. Yeah, it just gives you extra oomph, if that is acceptable.
Yes, exactly. You rise above the minutiae. No.
Yes. Yeah. The detail. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. I was trying to think of
a
clearer word. Yeah, you rise above the details of the source language.
Absolutely.
And more towards the concept, which is what we're looking for.
So just to add, this is an extra to the knowledge of languages. There is another point about knowledge of languages that sometimes is on the negative side. You have this plethora of languages at your at your disposal, and you find yourself in a situation where you have absolutely no idea what to say because you can't even think in any of them. You don't have anything at all. So everything disappears completely. Everything becomes completely devoid. You become devoided of any source or resources,
yeah,
to use.
Or you get to the analysis overload because you're thinking, I could use this one or this one or this one, which...
Yeah, and you don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I hope you enjoyed today's episode as much as I did. Today, we talked a lot about baggage, about the toolkits that we bring, about the lenses that we have to look and perceive the world around us. As interpreters, our language and our cultural upbringing influences how we see our work. The more experience we have, the more languages we know, the more cultural connections that we have give us more lenses, more binoculars, more wider angled views of the world. When we hear someone with an accent in our native language, what do we normally think of? Do we first think, they're not fluent in my language? Or do we think, this person knows more than one language? I think it's best that we should. From Marco's examples, he showed how knowing more than one language, coming from another country, he had more opportunities and advantages as an interpreter. It gave him more understanding of different concepts because he could see it from the different linguistic points of view. His cultural innate expressiveness gave him an edge when learning British Sign Language. But he brought out the key point that learning a language in the community, being immersed in the community's culture and language, is a great connection for interpreters. But being able to learn the language academically, in a course, at university, what have you, that gives us a deeper understanding of the language, and it gives us vocabulary to be able to discuss the language on a higher level and understand what we actually do when we interpret between two languages. Learning interpreting in the community and learning interpreting academically both have advantages. But as Marco said, it's best that we give a balance to that. Having the relationship with the community and a deeper understanding of what we do academically together can make us a better interpreter. So do we call it baggage or a toolkit? Knowing many languages, knowing different cultures, they both bring advantages to our work. Being able to see a concept from different language views, different cultural views, helps us pick the right way to express that concept for that situation. But it can also hinder us, can hold us back when we are trying to think of which concept to use, which point of view to use. And with experience, the advantages start to take over. Normally, when we use the word baggage in English, it feels more negative than positive. So I would say maybe we should call it luggage. No. Carry-on. Yeah, a carry-on bag. The carry-on is easy to travel with from situation to situation, and we pack in what's necessary, not the extras, but what's necessary for that situation. We also have in our baggage everything we learned in our training. If we learned from the assault course method, it was short term, it was very few examples, very little time to practice, and much less community relationship. In that regard, we focused greatly on how to do our job. We focused on the skill sets that needed to be learned quickly. And now we must continually educate ourselves in everything else that surrounds and supports that type of training, such as the community relationship, the language development, the emotional, ethical, and moral values that we must constantly evolve and improve. So, pack your bags, keep calm, carry on interpreting. I'll see you next week. Take care now.